Matt. Okay, so welcome. I'm going to tell you in the next hour about some crazy stuff that might or might not be true, but so I'll start with the punchline. It's kind of standing at my pulpit, I'll give you the heresy. So here's what the universe might look like on the very largest scales. You have this background that is expanding. It's actually expanding at an exponential rate. And then from this background, every once in a while, these bubbles will pop out. And this is a lot like water going to steam. This is the universe being able to inhabit different phases, just like water can be liquid or gas or solid. And these bubbles expand, and they form this collection of bubbles that is sometimes called the multiverse. And the reason it's called a multiverse is because somewhere in that mess of bubbles, so the theory goes, you will find our universe. So our universe in this model lives inside of one of these bubbles. So there it is. Okay, so the multiverse. Well, maybe I should start a little bit simpler. Maybe we should just talk about one universe first. So what do I mean by the universe? Actually, a lot of problem with the multiverse is semantics. So it's just, what are you talking about? I thought the universe was everything, right? I mean, that's the universe. That's the definition of the word. But if you ponder this for a second, you realize that what we think everything is has actually changed quite drastically. So let's start with the local universe. When we were cavemen, we thought this was the universe, right? We had our little forest home, and we, did whatever cave people do, and that was our world. And then, technology came along, and we realized the world's a little bit bigger than that. In fact, we live on a planet. And then, with the advent of telescopes, we realized that there were other planets that we inhabit, a solar system. And so this local universe, which is, sort of everything that we can interact with now, that's basically it, right? We can send probes to other planets and see what's there and, possibly go there ourselves someday. But right now, this is our local universe. This is everything we can interact with. Okay, so we can expand this sphere a little bit more. And we can talk about something else. That's the observable universe. And that's what it says. That's everything that we can see. That's everything that we can observe. And that includes both the stuff that we can interact with and the stuff that we can't. So distant galaxies are things that we can't really travel to and come back within a human lifetime. But nevertheless, we can see them, perhaps as they were in the past. So the important point here is that looking out, so this sort of distinction between the local universe that we can interact with and the observable universe is that much of the observable universe is seen as it was in the past. And that's just because light travels at a constant speed. So looking out is looking back in time. So if we have this distant galaxy, here this is like time and space, and I'll draw a lot of these schematic pictures of time and space. This is like a galaxy, and this is the Earth, maybe. So at some time in the distant past, it sends out light, and then we receive it in the future. So looking out is the same thing as looking back in time. So, with telescopes, we can see other stars. So this is a picture of a globular cluster that lives in the Milky Way galaxy. We can go out further. We can see other galaxies. And we can continue this exercise. Now the Hubble Space Telescope can see incredibly far. But eventually, we're going to run into a snag. And that snag is called the cosmic microwave background radiation. So what is that? So the CME is the radiation that was released when neutral atoms were formed. So very early in the universe, the story goes that things were very hot and dense. And in such a state, electrons and protons cannot find each other to make neutral hydrogen. So you have a plasma. And plasma is totally opaque. Light cannot penetrate a plasma. But at the same time, it's very hot. So the universe is full of photons, right? Just the infrared photons that you'd say, see, if you looked at a hot plate. So as the universe expands, it cools, and eventually this light is released. So here's another little cartoon picture of that. got all my electrons and protons. Here they're bouncing around, and the light is moving in this cosmic pinball machine. And then at some time, the universe becomes transparent. And that time is basically when all these electrons and protons recombine to form neutral hydrogen. This is an event that goes by a number of names. Sometimes it's called recombination, because you have electrons and protons combining. Sometimes it's called last scattering, because this is basically the last time that this light hits an electron or a proton. And then from that time forward, this light is free to travel, and we see it today. So one thing you can gather from this picture, actually, is that this light is everywhere, right? I mean, this is light that is released everywhere in space at a given moment of time. So while we see a certain little piece of the CMB, if I traveled to the Andromeda galaxy, I would see another piece of the CMB. It's just everywhere. You can't get away from it. It's surrounding us everywhere. Okay, but this is like a cloud, right? I mean, you know, the universe, we're sort of always, it's always overcast, because if I look out far enough back in time, you know, eventually I'll reach this cloud, and I just cannot use electromagnetic radiation to see past this cloud. It's totally impossible. You could imagine looking through eyes that could see something other than electromagnetic radiation and see back further. So for example, if we could see in neutrinos, we could see back even further, because neutrinos interact more weakly than light. If we could see in gravitational waves, then we could see all the way back to the beginning, because gravity doesn't like to interact with anything. But there's always this sort of catch-22, right? The stuff that interacts strongly is easy for us to see, but then we get this cloud. The stuff that interacts weakly is hard for us to see, but it allows us to see backwards. Okay, so wait 500 years and maybe we can see in neutrinos. And then you know, someone else can stand up here and tell you something different, a little bit more. That's what we have for now. And there's the punchline, we'll never collect light from further away. That's the cosmic cloud. And that denotes the boundary of our observable universe. So then there's something else, and this is a lot of what cosmologists do. And that is talking about the inferred universe. So this is not something we know because we directly see it, but it's something that we know because there's evidence of it in the cloud. So there's evidence of it at a later time. And we can try and reconstruct what happened in the past. But this isn't direct observation, this is really inference, right? So this inferred universe is sort of everything that we think exists based on our theoretical models. Okay, so what's the best theoretical model? I can't actually do anything without telling you what the model is. No one can do it. We need a model. So here's the model. You've probably heard it in a popular television show. So the story goes that the universe started very hot and dense, and it was expanding. So again, this is a space-time picture. And something I want to emphasize right at the beginning is that the Big Bang is not a point. It's not a point in space. It's actually a time. So the Big Bang is like a surface. It's everywhere. It's not like the whole universe expanded from a point. This is a common misconception, so I always like to just say this. And so I can look at a piece of the Big Bang. That actually makes sense. That's a physically meaningful concept, just like a piece of this room, right? There's a piece of the Big Bang, and any piece of the Big Bang will expand. So the universe expands. It gets filled with galaxies and stars, and it cools as it's expanding. And there's a very basic picture of this theory, this Big Bang theory, and that is that the universe as a whole, if we look at it, is very nearly homogeneous and isotropic. So it's almost the same any direction I look, and it would have the same properties any place I were to go. Okay, so it's totally homogeneous and isotropic. And this is one of the first things we learned about the Big Bang. And that actually came from observations of the CMB. So these two guys, Penzias and Wilson, were using this radio telescope to look for something totally different. And they saw this noise everywhere on the sky. and they thought it was bat shit, and they thought it was birds hanging out in their radio telescope, so they would go up there and clean out the bat shit and scare away the birds. But nevertheless, no matter how many birds they scared away or how much bat poop they cleaned up, they saw this noise, and it was still always there, right? Now, the most interesting property of this noise was that it was the same everywhere, right? So remember I told you earlier the CMB comes from a surface, right? So if the CMB looks the same everywhere, that's telling us something about the universe at that early time. It's telling us that the universe was basically the same everywhere. It's the same in every direction, the same in every place. And that, of course, earned them the Nobel Prize in 1968. So here's another picture of the CMB. If you've ever read a popular article or anything on the CMB, you probably see a picture that looks like this. But actually, that's a lie, because if I just plotted the data, it would look like this. It would look totally boring. It would be the same color in every single direction on the sky with these really tiny ripples that are about one part in 100,000. So those images are like changing the contrast on your TV by a factor of a million. That's the only way you get to see them. And, of course, we have now observed the CMB to enormous precision. I mean, there it is right there. The fact that we can see it, that I can show you that picture, just belies the prowess of these experimentalists, that they can actually measure these variations in temperature now to one part in tens of millions. So these measurements are really impressive. And what we learned is that while the universe as a whole, it seems, you know, homogeneous and isotropic, if we look at these lumps and bumps, it turns out that it's actually, I missed a word on this slide, it's actually statistically homogeneous and isotropic. So if I look at the statistics of these lumps and bumps, they're the same everywhere. Okay, so that's a very basic feature of our model, that the universe looks the same everywhere. Another basic feature of our model, which is quite puzzling, is the fact that the universe is actually undergoing accelerated expansion. So the rate of expansion is actually growing with time. And this, of course, was discovered by these three famous guys here, Dries, Perlmutter, and Schmidt, and it earned them the Nobel Prize in 2011. So they were looking at distant supernovae and actually directly measuring how fast the universe was expanding through the redshifting of the light, and comparing the observed luminosity that they would see from these supernovas. They're standard candles, so they emit the same amount of light every time, so by looking at the luminosity, you can figure out how far away they are. And they discovered through this direct measurement of the expansion that the universe is actually accelerating. It's expanding faster over time. Okay, so the universe is expanding. How do we describe that expansion? So we do that by asking Einstein. So Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us how gravity behaves on the largest scales. And gravity is what tells the universe how to expand and at what rate to expand. So here's Einstein's equation. You've got all this stuff on the left-hand side. And this is stuff that tells you about the curvature of space-time. These are things that tell you, if you've seen these rubber sheet analogies, that's the rubber sheet. And then you have the stuff on the right-hand side, and that's matter and energy. So this is the stuff that tells the rubber sheet how to curve. So Einstein's equation can be summarized in a sentence. Matter tells space-time how to curve, and space-time tells matter how to move. That's Einstein's. And so you can see the ingredients of the universe. Here are the ingredients of the universe. So this is the stuff that tells space-time how to curve.
No.
This is the cosmic pie chart. Right now we think the universe is, this is actually dated. I think this is from WMAP days, so I could put more significant digits and the pie changed a little bit. But this is 74% dark energy, 22% dark matter, and about 4% atoms and radiation and all the stuff we actually see. So I was told yesterday you learned about dark matter. That's actually totally insignificant. They should have told you about dark energy. And we have no idea what it is. It's just this stuff that I need to put into that equation to make the universe behave like we see. That's it. But what that stuff is, we don't know. That's an open question. Speaking of questions, by the way, I'm very happy to have interruptions, so if you want to ask them, please do. Okay, and this part of the pie, this dark energy piece, is the stuff that we think is responsible for this observed accelerated expansion of the universe. But we don't know what it is. It's just a term we put in that equation. Yeah.
How do we know that there's a difference between sort of dark energy and dark matter? Is it that in the equations that there is sort of an energy term that we're not sure of and that there's a matter term we're not sure of?
There's a very physical way of understanding the difference. Dark matter dilutes as the universe expands. It's like a set of particles. So if I have a sort of a fixed number of particles in a box and I double the size of the box, I'm going to change the density, the number density, or the physical density of those particles. Right? It's going to decrease like the volume expands, one over the volume. Dark energy is this stuff that does not dilute as the universe expands. So if you were to think of it as particles, when I double the size of the box, I'm actually making more particles. Bizarre, right? So it's this stuff that, you know, a good analogy for it is, our best model for it, I should say, is a scalar field, okay? So what is a scalar field? It's basically an object that takes a number at each point in space-time. Mm-hmm. So the temperature in this room would be a scalar field, yeah? So if I associate a number to each point in space-time, and that number has associated with it an energy, if I double the size of the box, well, there's still a number associated with each point in space-time, so I haven't really diluted that. So one way to make this happen is through these things called scalar fields. In fact, in cosmology and also particle physics, scalar fields are kind of the like tool that you can do anything with. So you often see things about scalar fields, and that's because, well, what is it? It's this very flexible object. It's just a number at each point in space-time, and I can endow that number with different properties, and I can make it do different things. So it's a nice tool.
Is it fair to say that if we take this as a constant, the dark energy, as it's accelerating, it gets less? So that's 74% diminish in time?
Increase. Yeah. So the thing is that this stuff dilutes as the universe expands. And this is, you can think of like an energy density, right? So, so by density, the total contribution from dark energy will win in the end. So if we wait 100 billion years, then this pie chart would be like a little sliver of atoms of dark matter, and then the rest would be dark energy. We'll talk a little bit about that.
And before, we had data that the universe was the expansion rate was accelerating. Was the dark energy still there, like theoretically, or was it the okay, so.
Yeah, so even before, sort of at a theoretical level, right? So people had debated for a long time about this. So there's this term in the equation, that's Einstein's cosmological constant.
Oh,
so Einstein, you know, introduced this a long time ago. But he introduced it for kind of a funny reason. He wanted to make a universe that was totally static, right?
Yeah.
And you needed that term to do that. But then we learned, Hubble told us that the universe was expanding. So he said, oh, that was a stupid mistake. Why would I put that term to make the universe static when you know it's actually expanding? But then the puzzle, the sort of theoretical puzzle for a really long time, was why that actually wasn't there. So there are various theoretical reasons to believe that you should have that term in the equation, but somehow it wasn't present in the universe. And then, of course, we learned that maybe you do have to put that term back in the equation there. And now the theoretical puzzle is why it's such a small number, and we'll actually talk about that a little bit. But it was there right from the beginning. Okay, so that's the pie chart. This is the piece that we associate as the cause of this accelerated expansion. And the model has a name. It's called Lambda CDM. And that's just named after the pi. So dark energy is lambda. That's that term in the Einstein equation. And then CDM means cold dark matter. So it's the dark matter piece. But we know something else about dark matter, which you might have learned about yesterday or earlier in the week, is that it's cold. And what's meant by that is that the velocity of the dark matter particles is not relativistic. Because if it was, it would be really hard to make the dark matter clump and form galaxies that we see today. So we kind of know from the presence of galaxies that dark matter has to be cold. OK, so that's the model, Lambda CDM. And that's currently our best model. It's very well fit by every piece of cosmological data that we know presently. It was most recently corroborated with extreme accuracy by the Planck satellite. And the universe is kind of vanilla and boring. Actually, I kind of hoped that it was going to get shattered, but it wasn't. It's just, OK, it works. Great. Now what? Now we invent crazy stuff to work on. OK, so let's go back to this inferred universe, because now we can actually talk about what we can infer. We have a theoretical model, and so we can go backwards in time from the CMB. So again, here's this time and space diagram. So I don't know if, we'll go there. So this is a light cone, right? This tells me about everything that travels slower than the speed of light could reach the Earth if it lives within this light cone. And in fact, we can't learn anything about what's outside the light cone. Unless it travels faster than the speed of light, we don't think anything does. We can't learn about that. So this is off limits. Anything outside the light cone is off limits. I can't learn anything about that, even in principle. So we've got this piece up here, which is the observed universe. And then below this is the inferred universe. And what we infer, if we go back in time, things are getting hotter. And eventually, things will get hot enough for nuclear fusion to occur. We think this is when sort of most of the helium and lithium in the universe was produced. Temperatures don't get high enough, and it turns out that it's not very efficient to produce the heavier elements. Those are actually produced later inside of stars. But you produce most of the helium and lithium during this time of nucleosynthesis, and the universe was hot enough for fusion to happen. And then if we go back even further in time, eventually you'll get to the Big Bang, but before we get there, we think this event called inflation happened. So inflation is this time when the universe actually underwent this very fast, super exponential accelerated expansion. And the expansion was so dramatic that it actually caused ripples in space-time itself, and those turned into galaxies and stars. So this is like the events that created all of the structure in the universe. You can think of it directly producing all these lumps and bumps you see in the CMB, and eventually directly producing everything else. So here's the inferred universe. Here again is the space-time picture. Here's the Earth. That's everything we can see. That's everything in our past light cone and everything we could infer. So this galaxy here, that's kind of part. It's just barely part of our observable universe, but maybe if it's a little bit beyond those, we have to infer their existence, right? I mean, I can't ever directly see them, but I don't think the universe ends at the edge of my light cone, just like the Earth probably doesn't end, if I drive in my car and I run out of gas, I don't think the Earth ends just because I can't get there. So that we think they're there, right? Those are part of the inferred universe. Okay, so given our model, we can also talk about what the future holds. So I mentioned this before. Let's talk a little bit about what is dark energy. So as I said, dark matter dilutes. Dark energy does not. And so dark energy always wins. As I mentioned, this is sometimes called a cosmological constant. That's that term in the Einstein equations, Einstein's biggest parameter. If you ask me, I think that's what dark energy is. It's just this term that's there in the equation. I don't know that it's going to get a more physical description. That might be all that it is. I think that's the most economical and elegant explanation, personally. So So if it is lambda, lambda is always there. Lambda never disappears. So you always have this dark energy, and it will just cause the universe to accelerate faster and faster and faster for all times. And kind of an interesting implication of that is that these galaxies that are far away will be expanding away from us faster and faster with time. So there are galaxies that we'll never catch. There are places we can never go in principle, we can never see in principle. So they really are truly part of this inferred universe, and they will always be. So what we see now, if lambda is really fundamental, is all we will ever see. We will never see more galaxies, we will never see more of the CMB, that's it. That's all we'll ever know.
Is it possible that, like, a galaxy on the edge of our observable universe could then disappear because it, you know, the relative speeds actually could be greater than the speed of light? Is it possible?
Yeah, so it's kind of like falling into a black hole, if you've ever seen a description of that. So let's say that I jump into a black hole, into this blackboard.
Yeah.
You wouldn't actually see me disappear, but what would happen is there would be this time dilation between you and me. And all the light that I would send you would get redshifted, so
okay.
It would get dimmer and dimmer.
Until it was
and
not
then
visible.
I would fade after, you know, an infinite amount of time, really, literally, I would fade away. And the same thing would happen to this galaxy. It would get further and further away, it would redshift more and more, and it would just sort of slowly fade, you know, fade out of existence.
Fade to black.
Yeah. Same with the sun. Eventually will fade out of existence. And so if you were a cosmologist and you're born in 100 billion years, it would be a really boring profession because
nothing
you have
to
look at. And you wouldn't get to learn anything. So really happy that I live now. So in this universe with a fundamental lambda, you get this splitting of the universe into the in principle, you know, observable part and the in principle unobservable part. And that's just life. But what is that? That is a set of observable universes, which, coming back to my original point, you can call a multiverse. So the multiverse isn't that fancy. It just means that there are places that I can't ever learn about, but nevertheless, I don't think the world ends at the limit of my knowledge. I infer the existence of other places. And in that sense, our best model of cosmology, lambda CDM, that fits all of this data wonderfully, predicts the existence of a multiverse.
Excuse me.
Yep.
This multiverse different than the one that is theoretically theoretically created when the quantum object makes a choice or whatever? Like, we're not talking the same thing, right?
Maybe. There may be interesting connections there. I don't know. That's usually thought of a little bit differently.
Yeah.
This is a bit more mundane in the sense that, you know, we're inferring that these things really exist. So there's another group of people listening to a much more exciting lecture, you know, 500 billion light years away. We infer their existence, but we'll never know, right?
But they're not
quantum mechanics case is sort of, it's similar, right? I mean, you decided not to wake up this morning, and then there's some other parallel universe where you didn't wake up this morning. You missed the lecture. But then it's like, is that real? It brings all the same questions. I mean, is that real? Are these real? I don't know. That's we're kind of, I can't tell you really. I'm a scientist, and so if I can't see it, I can't tell you. But there are these sort of thorny questions, and these are the types of questions that people that keep people up at night thinking about. I don't think there's a really good answer.
So do you even put a size to our universe, or you just say it's just unknown?
You can put a size if you know.
To the observable,
yeah,
yes, but
the observable universe, yeah, exactly.
But
so,
the bigger universe.
But the bigger picture, it's hard to say.
The megaverse.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is the size of the observable? Something like 15 billion light years across?
A little bit more than that, just because the way that light travels.
Oh, it's expanding.
Universe, yeah.
So what do you say?
It's more like, what is it, 30 or something?
Okay.
I forget the exact.
Okay.
Do these multiverses overlap?
No, and that's just a definition. So the multiverse is a collection of universes, and by definition, what I'm calling a universe are these sort of things that are separate.
But there
are
between them.
What's that?
What's between them?
Just other universe. Nothing exciting. Just more galaxies, more empty space. It's just that I can sort of divide my universe into cells, each of which constitute their own observable universe in the sense that I don't need to know about any of the other cells to describe what's going on in one of them.
So it'd be fair to say, it'd be like, you know, you have Texas in the U.S., but you got the United States. It's not
yes.
so much that it's actually a physical, different part of the United States. It's just the way we've defined it as its own state.
Totally.
But it's really all the same.
Totally.
Right?
I could get myself in trouble by saying such a joke right now.
Over here,
you can't
leave
Trump's eyes.
The red states and the blue states. Don't listen to what the states have to say. The blue states don't listen to what the red states have to say. They are their own observable universes.
Now I'm in trouble. If this is what's observable, that's our Earth in the middle, and that's our observable universe.
Yeah.
Might there be an Earth, a planet that would have an overlap with ours?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there would be. It's kind of a continuum, right? There's
yeah.
no like clear boundary.
Right.
But if I pick any point, I can tell you what the boundary is.
Right.
So our point will be different from some distant galaxy's point. Yeah.
Matt, could we say that the laws of physics that we observe are consistent with the other universes that are possibly out there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah? Okay.
I mean, if we go back here,
there's 96% we've not known that universe too.
Where did I have that here? I see this galaxy as it was in the past, right? So I know it exists, but then today, it's far enough away that I could never actually go there and confirm that it exists. So that's like just on the boundary, right? Okay, the known laws of physics tell me that this galaxy doesn't just disappear. Just keeps existing. It doesn't really care if I can see it or not. So take that 2 inches further. So the galaxy that's right next to it, maybe I could look at this galaxy and I could say, oh, well, based on its shape, I infer that there is another galaxy close by or something because it gravitates, right? Then yeah, I can't actually see that, but I have indirect evidence that it exists, and based on the laws of physics that I know, I don't think it just disappears, so it's probably there. I think the known laws of physics predict that these other places exist. Yeah.
When do the laws of physics break down? I look at the Big Bang, and I cannot see conservation of energy.
Uh-huh. So what happens at the Big Bang? Of course, the big question mark. There are ideas about what happens near the time of the Big Bang, but of course that requires the theory of quantum gravity, which we don't quite have yet.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned conservation of energy.
Right.
So it turns out that in Einstein's general relativity, the notion of conservation of energy that we're used to doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can't. There are conservation laws, okay, but they don't look like just conservation of energy. And so you can have things that look rather counterintuitive happen.
Sometimes.
Such as an expanding universe that you have stuff that doesn't dilute. That's a great example, right? That seems to violate conservation of energy. But it's just that you need to generalize your concept of conservation of energy to include energy and momentum, and you combine them into this object called the stress tensor. And the new statement of conservation of energy is a statement about that object. Okay. And so then you can get things that where it looks like energy is not conserved, but that's just because you defined the wrong quantity. That's not the conserved quantity in general relativity.
Thank you.
It's the craziest idea, being a researcher, that you would hope to be true at some point.
I'll tell you later. We're still in the boring stuff. So it seems like this best theory of the universe predicts that we live in a multiverse. And now we're just going to push that a little bit, and we're going to ask the question, okay, well, what now that we contemplate the existence of these other observable universes, like how different could they be? You know? It's a natural question. And then, of course, we might even push that further and try and ask, well, how do we know which one of these do we inhabit? Like, let's say they could be different. Which one are we in? So let's go back to this question, what is dark energy? As I said, my favorite thing is the cosmological constant, but that's just a number. And in fact, you can predict what this number should be using quantum field theory. So you know, in quantum mechanics, a harmonic oscillator, the ground state doesn't have zero energy, there's a zero point energy. So quantum field theory is a harmonic oscillator at each point in space-time, and it predicts that each point in space-time has a zero point energy. Okay? And it's a scalar field, so it's everywhere. This is the same concept, right? So there's some zero point energy everywhere. It's a number associated with each point in space-time. And the observed value of the cosmological constant is that fraction of the predicted value. It's the worst failure in physics. So it's something like 120 orders of magnitude off if you want to count the zeros. And that's a real problem. Okay, so why this is totally open question. But there's one answer. Some people hate it, some people love it. And that is to ask a slightly different question. You know, that's a prediction. So this, when I say it's this many orders of magnitude off, I mean that, you know, maybe I can change some things in the theory if you make it different. But this is sort of the generic prediction. So we can ask a slightly different question, which is, well, what if the cosmological constant actually varies between observable universes? So what if there's something that, you know, even if I have to add some really finely tuned ingredients, like asking my stick to stay up, it's hard to do, but maybe I can cancel some of those zeros, okay? Say it's possible. When you ask that question and you ponder what the universe would look like with different values of lambda, you get a very interesting answer. So lambda can be both positive and negative. If you make it too big and too positive, the universe is expanding so fast that you never form galaxies. It's impossible to form galaxies in structure. If you make lambda too negative and big, negative lambda does the opposite of positive lambda. It causes the universe to want to recontract. Okay, so if you make lambda too big and negative, the universe will just recontract, and then there's no galaxies because there's no universe. There's no us. Universe. And there is this sweet spot, which isn't too big, actually. If you make the observed value of lambda maybe one order of magnitude bigger, then you wouldn't have galaxies anymore. If you made it one order or two orders of magnitude smaller, the universe wouldn't be as old as it is today. And so we have this sweet spot, and the observed value, well, no wonder, it lives right in the middle of the sweet spot. Okay, so if I allow different values, then we are where we are. We see what we see because that's where we can be. And that's just it. So if these large values of lambda are somewhere, we just don't live there. We can't live there, so we don't see it. And this is the A word that people love or hate. This is the anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant. And it is sort of the same as the anthropic explanation for why we live on Earth. So there are other planets in the solar system. Even if they were all the same as the Earth, in some sense, they all have water and, you know, necessary conditions. You know, out here, water would be ice, so we would not live there. In here, water would evaporate, and so we don't live there. And then there's this Goldilocks zone that inhabits the, you know, very narrow band around the sun where the Earth could be. And why is the Earth, you know, 1 AU from the sun? It's because if we're farther, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be talking about that. And it's just that. And now that we know there are other planets, right, we now know there are thousands of other planets around different stars, we don't live around those stars because those planets aren't in the right orbit. And that's just as deep as it is. If you try and ponder, you know, is there a specific reason that the Earth is exactly this distance away from our sun? That's just the wrong question. planets can be at many distances away from the sun, and then we are where we are, because that's where you get liquid water. Question.
With respect to the cosmological constant, if we look at our Earth and our observable universe, that constant's constant. If you then go to the most distant galaxy we can find, go to that one, that has a new cone, mm-hmm. and part of that cone encompasses the cone from Earth. Mm-hmm. So that part of the cone would have the same constant as the Earth's constant, but it would have another piece of the cone outside of ours.
Yeah.
And that new entire cone would have a constant, cosmological constant.
Yeah.
So could you not keep doing that and leapfrog through and have it all constant?
Uh-huh. So great question. So we need to ask, if we're going to propose that the cosmological constant could possibly be different in different places, I need to tell you exactly how that can happen. And I need to tell you exactly how the different places fit together. Absolutely. And I promise you we'll get there. And if that doesn't answer it, then ask me again. So, what are the questions? Okay, so this is something that Weinberg did before we knew there was accelerated expansion of the universe. So in a real sense, it was a prediction of the cosmological constant. So he made this prediction, and then about 10 years later, it was confirmed. So we need to ask, okay, well, you know, this seems like it might be a plausible explanation for this puzzle, but is there actually a physical theory where you have a multiverse that lets the cosmological constant vary from place to place? And here is where string theory comes in. So nearly all of modern physics is based on the concept of point particles. The billiard balls of physics textbooks, and even more fancily, quantum field theory is the theory of point particles. And this worked until graviton came along, and I don't mean that one, I mean that one. So the graviton is the particle associated with the gravitational force, just like the photon is the particle associated with the electromagnetic force. And if we ask how gravitons interact, they are not at all monogamous. Gravitons interact with every other graviton that they can find. And so if I ask, what is the sum of all these different interactions that gravitons can have, which is sort of what tells me what the forces between the stick and my hand, I get a crazy answer. It's infinity. Because the theory of gravitons, quantum mechanically, just does not work. It's not well posed. It doesn't make any sense. Which is puzzling, because it worked for photons, and it worked for every other particle that we know of. But somehow for gravity, it just doesn't work. This thing that got us so far does not at all work. And the thing that comes to the rescue is to sort of generalize your notion of what a particle is. So instead of thinking of particles as a point, you can think of them as the next most complicated thing you can imagine, which is a line. And that's string theory. It's really that simple. So points don't work. Okay, what do I try next? How about lines? And it turns out that seems to kind of work. Okay. Part of the reason that you have this infinity, the answer to everything is infinity, is because, well, points, if I zoom in and I ask about an energy density, if an object, a particle, really has an energy, and I can get closer and closer and closer, the energy density of that ball that I draw around my particle just goes to infinity. Because I can get arbitrarily close to the particle, I never get there, it's a zero-dimensional object. But strings are different. Strings have a finite length, and so I don't get that divergence associated with looking at smaller and smaller resolutions of a point particle. And so when strings interact, which tells me about forces, then there's always a non-zero overlap. That overlap doesn't ever happen in an infinitely small place, and that's the thing that saves me. The other nice thing about strings is that they kind of unify all the forces and all the fundamental particles in the sense that I can describe gravity. Gravity is a closed string. I can describe different particles, and the different particles are described by open strings that have different modes on them. So just like, you know, I have different kinds of guitar strings that play different frequencies. I have different strings that can play different frequencies and give me different particles. So in a real sense, this sort of is this unified theory of gravity and all the other forces. It's really beautiful, but no one knows what it is, which is kind of the embarrassing part. So we can draw pictures. We can ask some questions. And other questions either are mathematically intractable, meaning we just don't have the correct mathematics to answer them yet. And we also can't really use a lot of the methods that work for point particles. So you can't write down the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian of string theory. We don't know what that means. We don't know what that is. So it's great. It seems to work. But you try and answer any question in detail, and you get stymied. Okay? That's that. Oh, there's one more thing, and that's that this only works if you add 9 dimensions of space. So the total dimensionality of the universe has to be 10. Yep.
How do you respond to the criticism that this is all just made-up nonsense, where you've invented these? And I mean, this in a nice way. You've invented these things to make the information you've got work,
yeah. But
it's just a cheat to make the sums add up.
I could level the same objection to Newton when he started talking about points. Well, what are these points? This doesn't look like a point particle if I throw this up in the air. How is it that you can claim to describe it by a particle with some mass? That's ridiculous. It's made up. And strings are the same. It's made up, right? We invent this concept to try and explain something about the universe. And it's a physical model. It is made up. I mean, I agree with that. I'm not going to object to that criticism. But so is every other physical model we make of the universe. It is an effective description of reality. It's not reality itself. So, you know, if strings have this property that they can unify gravity and quantum mechanics, so be it. Let's see how far we can get with that. And if there's some other made-up thing that we can invent that does a better job, then I'm not
sure. Brilliant. Thank you. It's perfect.
So we have to, we have to add these extra dimensions of space. So that's kind of the
thing. And it is only like 9 plus 1?
Yeah, 9 plus 1 works.
Because there's no longer like the 26 or something like that.
Depends on what version of string theory. So
I heard of that.
What level of made upness you
have? Is there a made up index?
10 works. Okay. 26 works too, but I don't think you'd explain everything we know about the universe with 26.
I heard 11.
Okay, 11 works too.
Okay.
10 can be encompassed in the theory of 11. It turns out. 10 is
the. So 10 is the new 11?
10 is the new 11.
Yeah.
This string theory goes to
the. But the thing is, you have mathematics to back up and support the idea of this model being able to explain. So it's not like we just invent, like, you know, it's not like we're saying, oh, unicorns are.
Yes.
You know, like, there is some sort of mathematical foundation to explain, and the more we can explain.
Can I get to buy a model?
Yes. There's a free number in this computation. That yields infinity. And that free number is the total dimensionality of space-time. So depending on the types of strings that I put in, I have to pick a very specific number to not hit infinity. And that number for certain types of strings happens to be 26. For other types of strings, it happens to be 10. For the unification of all string theories, which is called M theory, it happens to be 11. Okay, so it depends on the ingredients you throw. And of course, we want to pick the set of ingredients that gives us the physical world, that describes the physical world. So it turns out that this theory of 11, M theory, has different limits. Okay? So M theory tells you about different types of strings, okay, that live in 10 dimensions. And which one? Well, that's actually what I'm going to talk about in a second.
Okay.
And that's a great puzzle. We don't know which ones. Okay, so there are these extra dimensions. We don't see them because I only see length, width, height. And the solution to get rid of them, so that we cannot see them is to make them small. So at every point in space, we just make these extra dimensions very tiny, so that even though I could move in those directions, it would cost an enormous amount of energy, and it wouldn't get very far. So if I just have my human capacities, I will never be able to walk in the sixth dimension. If I had a particle accelerator the size of the solar system, maybe I could, but I'm not going to do it on my breakfast. Okay, so to keep these extra dimensions small, you need to add energy. Okay, something needs to keep them small. Otherwise, why would they be there? So I need to make this giant rubber band ball that keeps them small. And that's kind of actually a good analogy. So I take all these rubber bands. These rubber bands in string theory are actually flux lines. Just like in electromagnetism, I have flux lines. So I can confine the extra dimensions using the generalization of electromagnetic forces that exist in string theory. And all that energy I've stored in this ball is what we call lambda in our world. So at each point in space, I have this little extra dimension. And there's a lot of energy stuck in that little extra dimension. And that's precisely what we call lambda in string theory. That's what the explanation, that's what the cosmological constant is in string theory. But the problem is that there are a lot of rubber band balls that I can make. So I can reshape these extra dimensions, it seems like, in many different ways. So it's not a problem, it's a feature, I guess. So I can reshape these extra dimensions in many different ways. And for each way that I reshape it, I've got a different set of rubber bands, and therefore I have a different set of energies, right? And that gives me different values of lambda. So that's how string theory gives you a set of possible values for the cosmological constant. I guess that's the problem, okay? So the problem is that there's about, we think, between 10 to the 500 and infinity. There's a lot of ways you could do this, right? There's a lot of options. Now, originally when I said it's a problem, I mean, that's kind of a problem, right? So first of all, good luck enumerating 10 to the 500 different possibilities. Second of all, with so many possibilities, it's actually difficult to even confirm that one of those 10 to the 500 is the value we observe. And what rubber band ball does that correspond to? It's really difficult to answer that question. Nevertheless, it seems like string theory gives us this prediction that there are many possible values of lambda. And furthermore, you can kind of imagine deforming these configurations into one another. Maybe you cut a rubber band and then all of a sudden your ball expands in one direction. So you have this, what is known as this landscape of string theory, which in a very real sense is sort of a potential energy landscape. And each of these little bumps correspond to a different stable configuration of these rubber band balls, the compact dimensions. And you can see to get from one valley to another, I have to add some energy. And there's a really great analogy here. This is actually a plot taken from a paper on protein folding. So proteins can fold in many different configurations. And if I add energy, if I heat up a vial of proteins, then I can get a different set of shapes, right? And that just corresponds to moving around the potential landscape. And so the analogy with the universe is, well, maybe if I heat up the petri dish of the universe, then I can get different values of lambda, different shapes in different places. And that's what comes next. So we want to ask the question, okay, there are all these possibilities, but can I actually make them happen somewhere? Or are they just possibilities? Are they realities or are they possibilities? And if so, maybe Weinberg was not so crazy. So let's talk about this. You can think of these just real quick as different phases too, right? So just like I can think of the free energy of water, and talk about phase transitions of water to liquid water to steam. We can do the same thing with the universe. So just like liquid water goes to steam by the formation of bubbles, I heat up this pot, I get bubbles of gas in the background liquid. Still water, but now it has a different character. I can do the same in cosmology. I can have cosmological phase transitions And the kind of bizarre thing is that they can happen even at zero temperature, so I don't even need to heat the pot up. That's bizarre, but true. And so the picture looks something like this. So I have this landscape, and let's say I start with a universe where everything, where my compact space looks like this donut, okay? And let's say that donut has a lot of energy in it, so lambda is big. Then if I wait long enough, I'll have a phase transition. And in that place where the phase transition occurred, I went from the donut to a sphere, and let's say the sphere carries less energy, so now lambda is small. So I have this little pocket where lambda is smaller. And that little pocket can start hot, and it can expand and get cold. And that looks kind of like our universe. That's a cartoon. There's, of course, a lot of details that go into there, but it's a cartoon. So you can have these phase transitions, and then in these little pockets, you can have a universe that more or less looks like what we see, inside of which the value of lambda is a little bit different. So this comes back to the question that was asked, well, how does lambda vary from place to place, and by bootstrapping my way from galaxy to galaxy to actually see if lambda changed? So the answer is no, but for a little bit of a different reason, but let's say you could do that. Here's what you'd see, like if you could go there would be this phase boundary, right? And that's how you know lambda is changing. It would be a wall. Okay, so something kind of funny happens. So if I have a universe that stays static, or it's expanding, but it's not expanding and accelerating, then if I form a pocket and it expands, then there are pockets around it that will grow and expand, and eventually I'll boil my whole pot of water. This is like the pot of water, right? It boils eventually if I leave it on the stove for long enough. But something really weird happens if the universe is accelerating, because I form a pocket, but then by the time I form another pocket, the universe has expanded, and then it keeps expanding, and then it can get out of control. It's like I've got a fire truck, and I'm trying to boil a pot of water, and the fireman is just keeping putting water in my pot, and I keep trying to boil the water, but he's putting more water in the pot, and it never gets boiled. And this is an idea called eternal inflation. Okay, so I have lambda. Lambda makes the universe expand or inflate, but then I can't get rid of it. Once I start with it, I cannot get rid of it. And so so that means that you have this expansion going on literally forever. You can't stop it. That's eternal inflation. But this is great for Weinberg's idea, because it tells us that now I can have all these different pockets that, they kind of remain separate, but inside of those pockets, lambda can be different. Maybe I go from the torus to a sphere here, or I go from the torus to a double torus here, or I go from the torus to something else here. And so I can populate all of these different places in this potential energy landscape, just in the same way as if I had a vial of proteins and I heated it up. Some of the proteins would go one way, some of them would go the other way, and then if I analyzed what was in my vial at the end of the day, I'd have an assortment. I'd explore different places of this landscape. And so that could be why we see the value of lambda we see. This is a viable explanation. And so that brings us back to this picture I showed in the beginning. Now you understand a little bit about what I was talking about. This is the movie of what that process would look like. I have these different places that now take different values of lambda. And then depending on what I put in the theory, maybe other things can change. Maybe in some bubbles there is no such thing as electrons, or they're really heavy, or maybe in other bubbles, a Higgs has a different mass or something. And so it's not arbitrary. It depends on the ingredients I put in. But the main problem is that I don't know what ingredients to put in, because no one knows what string theory is. That's life, but that's kind of where it's. So it's a crazy idea. Yeah.
So if it's constantly changing, yeah. does that mean that our constant is fluctuating within that acceptable value, that acceptable value range?
No. So in our universe, if the cosmological constant were to change, you'd know about it, because there would be this bubble that would form, and it would scream at you at nearly the speed of light. It would carry a huge amount of energy and momentum. It would run into you, and then you would die. If it does fluctuate, it doesn't happen very often because the universe is quite old. We haven't been hit by this yet. But yeah, you could know. Just be a very short celebration.
Yay!
Okay, so it's a crazy idea, but we're scientists. So we need to know if this idea is even in principle experimentally verifiable. You know, like these other bubbles with different lambdas, going back to your question, could actually tell that they're there. And there is a way. Because these bubbles, while they're expanding away from each other, they don't evolve in complete isolation. In fact, if I concentrate on any fixed bubble, it's going to get hit by a number of other ones, the ones that happen to form close enough that they can do so. And these collisions can actually provide an observational test of this idea. The test of the idea that we live in a bubble and there are other bubbles. I still can't tell you about an infinite number of bubbles because they will remain outside of my light cone. But I can tell you about maybe a few. Maybe I can tell you there's more than one observable universe in these bubbles. So here's a little cartoon of what that might look like. So here's a bubble. This bubble contains our universe, right? And because I told you that looking out is the same as looking back in time, think of this bubble as a gobstopper, where the different colors represent different periods in the cosmological evolution. So here we are in the middle of the gobstopper. If we go out, we see the CMB. That's a sphere that's around us, right? That's one layer of the gobstopper. And then we think we have this region of inflation, right? And then far enough away, we have the wall of our bubble, okay? The bubble that we live in. And let's say we happen to get hit by another one. Now, what can happen is, basically, there's always a winner and a loser. So you hit this other bubble, and the question is, does it just keep expanding into our bubble so that if I see it, I get hit by that interface, or do we expand into the other bubble and eat it up? So we're here talking about this, so we must have been the winner. But we might be the loser. We might be the loser.
Later.
Later, yeah. And again, that experiment will be very short. So what happens is you form this shock wave, and that kind of comes out, right? And it disturbs the different layers of our gobstopper. And it disturbs them in such a way that we can actually go out and look for. And that is because the anisotropies in the CMB temperature actually encode density perturbations. So the places that are endowed with a little bit more hydrogen are a little bit dimmer, it turns out. The places that are a little bit less are a little bit brighter. Yes?
Could you rephrase the second line for me, please? I have no idea what it means.
The second line.
The temperature. I am just referring to density. I feel extremely smart of bringing that.
So what I mean is that picture. So if I look at different places, the temperature is slightly different. And that is a temperature anisotropy. So isotropy has to do with the direction you're looking. So if the temperature is a little bit different in different directions, we would call that a temperature anisotropy. Yep.
Okay.
And the places that so what happens is you're literally seeing like a projection of this. Think of the temperature as a proxy for the density of the gas at this time. So the blue spots are going to be places that have a little bit more gas. And the red spots are going to be places that have a little bit less gas. So if this collision comes along and it disturbs the density of gas in different places, then that's going to leave a signature in this temperature. Okay, I'll leave that for now. So in a very exaggerated way, this is sort of what that would look like. You get these bruises that would form.
And they would change over time.
No, they would be fixed in time. This is something that happened a really long time in the past, so it won't change in time. And so we can go out and look for these features. So here's a set of predictions. Basically, you could turn the data into a probability distribution that there are n of these bruises. And if we measure the data and we get something that looks like this, that would tell us that most likely there are 6 bruises. Here, it would most tell us that most likely there are 4 bruises.
And bruises then, mean that we've won 4 times? Or
yeah, yeah, we've won 4 times.
4-0.
And if it's 0, that means that there's no evidence for this happening, right? There's no evidence that we hit one of these other bubbles. And here is what the data says. So you can go out and look for these, and what you find is that this distribution is peaked around 0. So most likely we haven't run into another bubble. So that's the first test of this idea. But now that we can test the idea, we can actually go back and we can learn something about string theory. So I can tell you, string theory model X is unacceptable because it predicts that we see these bruises, and we don't see them. So we can go backwards and we can put constraints. It's not too different from particle physics, where you go and look for different particles. You build the best collider you can, you look for things. Sometimes you find them. We got lucky with the Higgs. But sometimes you just get constraints, and that's where we are. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say. It's exciting times for cosmology, and I guess that's what I want you to take away. Thanks.
Some takeaways.
So the craziest idea that you would believe that you would like to be true at some point
is that there are other bubble universes that ran into ours, and that we will eventually find evidence for that, and then possibly learn something about living in a multiverse. Craziest idea that I would feature.
Could it be possible, if we use the analogy from the waves, that they come together, they give you a little bit of a bump, and then they just pass unaffecting each other? Could that be plausible?
So Einstein's equation tells you that no, that could never be possible, because whenever I have a collection of matter, in this case it would be the colliding bubbles, then I always create a gravitational disturbance.
Yeah, but could that be just localized there?
Even if it is localized, as long as it lives within our past light cone, we can see it. So you can hide your mistakes. there will be something there. How detectable it is, that's a different question, but there will be something. There will always be something.
So is it predicted that these collisions can have different intensities?
That totally depends on what these walls are made out of, their structure, and that's the thing we can learn, right? So the brightness of that bruise, the size of that bruise, those are all things that tell you about that event.
So the size of the bruise, then, as they collide, you said that the bruise evidence wouldn't change with time because we're looking back in time. Mm-hmm. But we're looking back in time, and if the collision progressed from first contact to larger, that progression happened over time. So as we look back in time, would we not see that progression?
I'll try and explain this, but this is a tough one. So in these bubbles, it turns out that the thing we call the Big Bang in our universe is like the wall of our bubble. So the bubble is the wall of the bubble is always in our past. And I'll try and draw this. So this is time and space. And I can imagine a bubble that formed at some early time if I were to cut it this way. So at this time, if we look over here, I'll draw like X and Y. So that would be a bubble with some size at this time. And then if I look at a later time, that would correspond to a bubble that has grown, right? And so I have time and space, and Einstein tells us that there's no preferred way of splitting space and time into space and time, right? So I can pick a different foliation. I can pick a different definition of time. And in that different definition of time, what we call today, so this would be now, actually looks like this. So if I go out in distance, I never get to the edge. I never get to the wall. So this is constant time. And if I go back further in time, this surface, which is kind of like the Big Bang, kind of like the bubble wall, is this is what we call the Big Bang. So different surfaces of time would just sit inside here. And that's kind of where this picture of the gobstopper comes from, because now I'll test your visualization skills and my drawing skills. If I slice it like this, you can see I sample all the different times. So I sample the Big Bang, I sample, say, the CMB, I sample now. And that's where this picture comes from. So this picture in the slide is like slicing things in this way.
From above.
Yeah, kind of from above, that's right. Yeah, I can't draw that in the dimensions, I apologize. But yeah, kind of like that, right? And it's just that the different surfaces we call constant time are not the same in our universe. So you can see that anything that gets to me now, something happened here, you yell at me, and then I want to hear that sound, that has to come through all of the different cosmological times. It has to go through every layer of the gobstopper. So all of these collisions, all of this stuff from the outside world, in a sense, is always in our past. And that's why, so it's like history, right? We just see the wreckage, and now we need to figure out what happened. And that's why it doesn't really change in time. So it's like the stuff is already there, so it's not going to change in time. Already happened.
So the other bubble that collides, the collision is entirely in our past.
Yes.
All over the intersection of.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. What did you say?
It's always in the past. That's the punchline.
And that's why we say that in this model where you have the underlying expanding space, each bubble, although from the outside it looks finite, is in a universe which is infinite from the inside.
Yeah, each bubble is an infinite universe on the inside.
Yeah.
That's right.
So any collision that's happened, it's there, the evidence is there, so there's no future.
No,
that there is no sense of anything that is available to be understood has its wreckage to be found or not already.
Depends. Yeah, excellent question, leading to very deep questions. So it depends on what lambda is, and it depends on if lambda is here to stay forever. If lambda is here to stay forever, I told you that we've already seen everything we'll ever see. Right? Our past light cone cannot grow, and therefore what we have now is what we'll always have.
So if lambda's different, your answer to me is different.
Yes, so if lambda, I don't know, if lambda disappeared tomorrow, but not because there was another bubble, I don't know, just let's say it disappeared, or maybe we're wrong. Maybe somehow experimentalists are wrong and lambda is really zero. Then our light cone can grow with time, so that 100 billion years from now, we'd actually get to see more. And then maybe you'd find this wreckage if you wait 100 billion years. Right? For practical purposes, in either case, it doesn't matter. It's not going to change. Any other questions? Yeah?
I'm still confused the idea of an observable universe. Sort of being in some cases, I thought I heard you using multiverse to mean within this one place there are different observable universes. Mm-hmm. But I'm also trying to wrap my head around this. So the Big Bang, I still have this idea that it's a place, which I hear you say it was a time instead.
Right.
But I still have this vision that like we think that everything came from the Big Bang.
Uh-huh.
So are you in your original image, movie,
uh-huh.
is that different Big Bangs that are
yeah,
happening?
Yeah, yeah. There are
okay.
many things that in each bubble people would call a Big Bang. It's just that here it's a very much more mundane thing. It's just the wall of the bubble is like the edge of where the properties of the universe change. And where all of that came from, like, now you have all these bubbles forming, but where did they come from? Where did the stuff that they were forming from come from? You know, is there like a meta, an uber big bang or something? I don't know what to call it, right? And the answer to that is I don't know. That's an open question. It's certainly true that you can make the universe future eternal, because once you get this thing going, you can never make it stop because it's always more bubbles, right? Whether or not it's past eternal is actually a different question. And that is your question. You know, if I go back far enough in the past, before there were any bubbles forming, was there a big bang that gave rise to everything? And there are some ways, there are some models where the answer to that question is yes, and there are some models where the answer to that question is no. So the universe can be eternal in both the past and the future, but it doesn't have to be. And these are questions that I don't know that I'll ever be able to, or anyone will ever be able to answer. So probably a philosophical debate that will go on forever. Yeah.
What's the consensus in the community vis-a-vis Weinberg's idea? Like, is there a majority that supports, or half and half, or everybody thinks it's crazy, or?
It's probably half and half, but no one has a better idea.
So why would the people that, on the other, the people that are not supportive, what would they sort of say is the?
That the entropic principle is not science. And we're respectable physicists, so we should not be talking about the A word. I don't know how I feel about that. I kind of have mixed feelings on that. So I don't know. But that's I would say the general opinion.
What impact would
I have a question back to
you? Just a much more simple question. The question that our students always ask us is, so what's at the edge of the universe, what's beyond the edge of the universe? So in this, you kind of say there is an edge of the universe, which is where our gravitational constant changes. How would you answer that question now to a group of students? It's the one question they always ask.
Yeah. There's an edge of the Earth. Right? So I have the Earth and I have space. In that sense, there's an edge of our universe. Right? So there's our universe, which is like the Earth, but then I can leave the Earth and maybe I can go somewhere else. That would be like the outside. Now the Earth and space around it are all part of a bigger picture, right? So that's, in this analogy, that would be like the multiverse. There are boundaries between places that look different, but they all are a part of this big picture, the multiverse. I don't know if that is a good explanation, but I guess that's what I've come up with.
What would be the impact of discovering the graviton, the gravitational waves? Will you prove that everything that you've been saying is closer to reality?
Yeah, very good. Certainly the detection of gravitational waves tells you something about the earliest moments, right? So if we go back to this picture, if we can see gravitational waves, remember, gravity waves are not like photons, so there's no cloud inhibiting our view. So in principle, if you could scream in gravity waves to me from the outside of the bubble, I could get them. So there are traces of this outside world in gravity waves that are available for us to see. And you can look for them. Right now, the consensus on whether or not we've actually detected primordial gravitational waves is a little bit up in the air. So you might have heard about this BICEP 2 experiment. Mm-hmm. They claimed that they detected primordial gravitational waves. That was the press release. So let's talk about what they actually detected. So what they actually detected was the polarization of the CMB, a very particular pattern in the polarization of the CMB. It's called the BMOS. So just like photons scattering off of a pond, you know, like reflection of sunlight, it gets polarized from that scattering. And a certain fraction of the CMB photons on their way to us hit something and scatter, and therefore get polarized. Okay. It's a small fraction, it's a few percent of all CMB photons rescattered. And in doing so, they're imprinted with a sort of, again, it's like a picture of the density. So the places where there's more photons, you're more like more gas, you're more likely to scatter and more likely to get polarized. So the polarization tells you something about the distribution of gas. And gravity waves produce this very characteristic distribution of gas. And they saw that pattern. They saw this B-mode pattern. I have no qualms about that. I think they definitely detected this, which is a superb achievement. I mean, this is like signals that are, you're looking for temperature differences that are like one part in 10 million, say. So this is a really amazing experiment. Now the problem is, what does that imply? Because not only do primordial gravitational waves produce these B modes, but also sort of more mundane stuff like galaxies and crap in the way, they also make B modes at some level. And so you have this conundrum where you need to tell the difference between the astrophysical foregrounds, which are these galaxies and stuff, and the primordial signal. Now, there are ways to do that. Okay, so one way to do that is you measure the CMB at different frequencies. Because it turns out that the astrophysical foregrounds depend on frequency in a characteristic way, but the primordial signal is independent of frequency. So if you measure this thing at different frequencies and you always get the same answer, you have confidence that it's primordial. But living on the Earth sucks, because just like the microwaves can be used to heat up your water glass, they can also, you know, the water in the Earth's atmosphere absorb the microwaves. So you're kind of restricted from Earth's measurements on what kind of frequencies you can measure. And that means that this experiment cannot look at a lot of frequencies and therefore has a really hard time distinguishing these foregrounds from the primordial signal. The other catch-22 is that to send something up in space that could do this really well is really expensive. So this is what we have to work with. There's some controversy right now about whether or not the signal that they saw is really foregrounds or really primordial. But we're going to learn a lot more when the Planck satellite, which is going to release its data in like 2 or 3 months, gives us some more information about that. So we'll probably know a little bit more in 3 months. If they come out with a confirmed detection, then gravitational waves, right? Then you can look for this stuff, I mean, you know, from the earliest times, and that's really exciting.
So was sent with that purpose?
What's that?
The Planck satellite was sent with that purpose to?
It's kind of a side project. Yeah, so its main purpose was to measure the primary CMB, the unscattered CMB, and they did that to enormous precision, confirmed lambda CDM, and made my life really boring. but now this is the other thing they can do, and they will do, and that's coming soon.
Thank you very much for that.